more on airframe icing, and when is VFR also IFR? I'm Paul Platt, and this is Aero News. Welcome into this Aero News special feature, and thanks for downloading us today. I'm Paul Plack, and I'm here, as I am most Mondays, with Bob Miller, a certified flight instructor and now flight school owner in the Buffalo, New York area, who publishes Over the Airwaves, the journal for the proficient pilot. It's available on the internet if you want more information, overtheairwaves.com. Bob's January issue talked about airframe icing, very serious business. We want to talk more about that topic because obviously it's that time of year in the Northern Hemisphere. Bob, thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure, Paul.
Tell us what it is about airframe icing, A, that makes it so dangerous, and B, that catches us so off guard.
Well, icing has been the subject of great study, great anxiety, great fear and wonderment over the many years of aviation. And those of us who fly in and around icing conditions on a regular basis see it a little bit, perhaps a little too casually. Those who are not familiar with icing, who fly in the more southern climates, view it with a great deal of gravitas, far much more than it deserves. So what I attempted to do in an article in the January Over the Airwaves is to maybe demystify the problem of icing and put the facts out there just as they are and try to explain it aerodynamically. And all I did was first explain that icing, one, adversely affects lift. Number two, icing adversely affects drag in a very, very dramatic way.
Anybody who's gone outside and cleared off an outdoor object in a climate where ice can form on it overnight knows that a little bit of ice weighs a lot. So the weight thing is easy to understand. The drag thing is fairly easy to understand. The thing that's maybe less intuitive for a lot of people would be the influence that icing would have on the angle of attack of an airfoil. And I say that because in most cases, ice will tend to form in roughly the same shape as the underlying airfoil. So why do we wind up with this disparity in where your airplane will stall?
Well, it does and it doesn't. It does tend to form along the same shape of the wing of the airplane, but ice tends to be rough edged, particularly if it's rime ice, and it's not perfectly contoured with the wing. We know that as the angle of attack increases to a certain point known as the critical angle of attack, we'll call it for argument's sake 16 degrees of angle, the wing will stall. When we have ice on the leading edge or in any part of that wing, the angle of attack at which the wing will stall drops precipitously, almost by 50% in some cases, so that we will have a wing stalling at 8 or 9 degrees rather than 16 degrees. When we're carrying a lot of weight and the airplane is slowed down because of drag, we have to pitch the angle of attack upward. We pitch it up to maybe 8 degrees and then initiate a turn and a banking situation. Now we have increased the stall speed as a result of the bank. We have a situation now where the pilot is taken totally by surprise, and we have an airplane now that's in a full stall condition, maybe at just 10, 8, or even 7 degrees angle of attack.
One of the other interesting things you point out about this icing phenomenon is when you lower the angle of attack at which your airplane is going to stall, it's lowered even more when you're in a turn. And so now you come into a situation where a student may be flying along in cruise, and by student, I use that term loosely, a private pilot with 100 hours who's never had this happen before is still a student in this example, mm-hmm. is flying along in cruise and goes to make a turn, and suddenly finds that the speed at which he's been cruising is now below his stall speed in a bank with the ice he's carrying. And this goes back, doesn't it, to this whole principle that many flight schools don't want you to ever experience a stall or spin. They want you to avoid them. Well, here's a situation where you've done all the things that normally would avoid it, and you're still going to be in one.
Well, Paul, you have hit the nail right on the head on that one. With a little bit of ice, the airplane, we're really test pilots at that point, and the airplane is not going to behave the way we expect it to behave. And there's a couple of principles then we need to employ. If we are carrying ice, fact number one, increase airspeed. By increasing airspeed, we're going to lower our angle of attack. So we want to keep the angle of attack as low as possible. Number two, carrying ice, we want to make our banks very, very gentle, nothing more than standard rate or even half standard rate, because we don't want to exacerbate that stall speed problem by increasing the bank angle. Number three, something that we need to think about, we do not want to go suddenly changing the shape of the airframe by lowering flaps, particularly when the possibility of tailplane icing is present. That is when we're picking up icing on the tail feathers of the airplane. But as I tried to point out in the article, if we just think of these two things, one, icing on the wings lowers the angle of attack at which the airplane will stall, and icing on the wings will increase exponentially the amount of drag that occurs when we are increasing our angle of attack. We know, for example, that increasing the angle of attack increases induced drag. When we're carrying ice, that increase in induced drag is exponential. It increases about four times as much for each doubling of that angle of attack.
Right. Bob, there's a lot of background in icing for aircraft in general. Not so much background in icing, flying into icing with some of the newer composite aircraft. Is there a difference?
Yes, Paul, we have to be concerned about the effect of icing on some of the newer glass composite airplanes. Number one, because the wings are thinner, and we know that thinner, sharper surfaces tend to accrete ice faster than larger, wider, bulbous wings, say of a Bonanza or a Cessna 182. The Cirrus and the Columbia, both wonderful airplanes. Love to fly them. They cut through the air like a knife through warm butter. But those wings are narrower, and because they are, if they accrete ice a little more quickly than the legacy aircraft, simply means we have to take some evasive action more quickly. The other factor is we simply do not have a lot of experience yet with these newer airplanes in icing conditions. Again, the legacy airplanes, we have a pretty good idea of what they can and cannot do. We just don't have enough experience yet to determine what the new glass composite capability, glass composite aircraft capability is in icing conditions. And this is just another reason for operators of these airplanes to be doubly aware of the likelihood of getting into icing and avoiding it at all possible costs, of course.
We're talking with Bob Miller, who is a CFI and flight school operator in the Buffalo, New York area, and who publishes Over the Airwaves, the journal for the proficient pilot. We'll be back to talk about another wintertime issue in a moment, and that is when it might be VFR and IFR at the same time. I'm Paul Plack, and you're listening to a special feature from Aero News.
At Cirrus Design, we don't ignore the fundamentals of aviation design. We just give them an ingenious new interpretation. The Cirrus SR20 G2. Interested in a substantial airplane that remains practical and affordable? Whether you're a non-pilot looking to begin flying lessons, a pilot needing personal transportation, or a fleet customer selecting the best plane to meet the demands of a multiple aircraft operation, consider the SR20 G2. To learn more, call 888-750-9927 or check us out on the web at cirrusdesign.com.
Welcome back to this Aero News special feature. I'm Paul Plack, talking with Bob Miller of Over the Airwaves about some wintertime boogeymen that we all have to face as pilots, especially if we're not instrument rated. And Bob, you wrote in your January edition of Over the Airwaves about a dark, moonless night in which it was both VFR and an environment which presented IFR challenges. Set this up for us.
Yes, this example that I use was more or less a hypothetical example where an individual who was typically flying around urban areas, the lights of the city were always present to provide kind of a horizontal or a horizon reference for his night flying, took off with his family and went to visit grandma out in the country. And on the way back, went to the airport. It was nighttime. Got into the airplane. Of course, checked with flight service, got a complete briefing, and was assured that the conditions were VFR at the time. Ceiling was 9,000-foot overcast ceiling. Certainly plenty of VFR underneath to operate in, and visibility was greater than 6. So the individual loads his family into the airplane, and they take off, and they see the runway lights whizzing by. As they lift off into the nighttime sky, two things he notices with great dismay. Number one, the lights of the city were not there. Of course they were not there. They were flying over open terrain. There was no houses. There were no houses, no street lights, nothing below to provide any kind of situational awareness. Mm-hmm. He looked up, and of course there was no moonlight. There was no stars to see. So he had nothing but black above, black below, and he's a VFR pilot. And he's wondering, where is my horizon? Keep in mind now, Paul, the conditions are VFR from
right.
a meteorological standpoint, but from an operational piloting perspective, he had no outside visual references to a horizon. And in my hypothetical situation, the outcome was not good. There was just no way for him to keep his airplane level, aside from reference to the instruments, and lacking the proper training in that regard or an instrument rating, he had no way to maintain himself, and at that point, the tragic event happened.
Well, and as you point out, statistically, I mean, literally, statistically, you have an average life expectancy as a VFR pilot of 45 seconds if you find yourself in that circumstance.
Once the airplane starts turning and you're not comfortable on the gauges and your brain and your inner ear tells you one thing and reality is another, you're absolutely right, Paul. The outcome is not good. We know that the number one killer of all pilots is continued VFR flight into IMC conditions or IFR conditions, instrument flight conditions. Again, from a flight pre-flight briefing perspective, it may be VFR. This also happens on flights out over water, out over open water, where in Florida, for example, westbound departures from Naples out over the Gulf of Mexico at night on a moonless night and no lights on the water can be a devastating situation for a VFR-only pilot to get into. That leads me to just two points. The first point is primary pilots working on their private pilot certificate must take seriously the notion of having at least 3 hours of for real in the clouds instrument training so that they can see as a private pilot student just how insidious this problem is, number one. And the other point I want to make is if you're going to do any kind of serious cross-country flying, at night, certainly, an instrument rating is a bare necessity. I mean, it has to be there in order for us to operate safely. There have been countless cases of this scenario where VFR pilots operating at night on a moonless sky over featureless terrain just get themselves into a situation that they can't handle. An instrument rating is not difficult to obtain, or even instrument experience is not difficult to obtain.
Well, you know, I had an experience very much like this, Bob, in my early flight training. I was signed off to solo, and here in Oregon, we have coastal areas which are often fogged in or have bad weather. It's hard to fly to them. I really wanted to do it, and I finally found a forecast for one night where the weather was going to be near perfect. I was going to fly over the coast range, as we call it here, along the Pacific coastline in Oregon, from an inland location to the Newport Airport. And it was an absolute point-and-click flight in terms of VFR conditions. From the pattern at my departure airport, I could see the beacon at my destination airport on the other side of the coast range once I got enough altitude. And so it was very, very much a comfortable environment. However, in order to make my approach into the airport, I had to pass the airport and then descend, turn back and descend. Once I got out over the ocean, I was stunned at how quickly this happened to me. I was in an aircraft with very poor view behind me, and once I passed that coastline, and there was nothing there. I mean, it was a very high overcast, no moon, no lights on the ocean. By the time I even, you know, took a few seconds to look down at the instruments, I was in a 30-degree bank. And you know, so I knew what to do, and I did it. But, I mean, I can see how this could, you know, you don't even know what's happening to you.
Well, great credit to your flight instructors, Paul, because they instilled in you an ability to fly solely by reference to the instruments, with or without a rating. I mean, the fact is the airplane does not know it's in IMC conditions, but the pilot can control the airplane simply by reference to the instruments. The problem is the insidious nature of these conditions. We lose more pilots due to continued VFR flight into IMC condition over every other possible flight risk there is out there. It could be due to a moonless night, featureless terrain, or a sudden passage of a fog bank over the airport. The airplane does not know it's in IMC conditions. The airplane, for all intents and purposes, it's just a dumb machine. It's up to us as pilots, however, to be able to interpret the instruments to know whether or not our wings are level. It is not difficult. It is not difficult to learn to fly solely by reference to the instruments. This is something that each and every one of us needs to put into our flying. Our training objective is to get that instrument rating. Not that we're going to go out and fly in the hard IMC conditions intentionally, but during those events, when those circumstances arise, these are skills that will save our lives.
All right. Well, Bob, as always, we appreciate your wise, sage counsel, and we'll look for you again next Monday.
Thanks a lot, Paul.
Find out more about Bob's writings and Over the Airwaves at overtheairwaves.com. You've been listening to a special feature from Aero News. On the web, you'll find us at www.aero-news.net. That's A-E-R-O. I'm Paul Plack. Thanks for listening. Have a clear and unlimited day.